Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Multiple Myeloma. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 905 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from many different parts of the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Jamaica, Kenya, Korea, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you truly are an international group of people on this call today. This program was made possible by an educational grant from Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company. This program was made possible also by support from Onyx Pharmaceuticals. So I really want to thank our funders for supporting this program, as well as their collaboration in making this program possible. Now, you received from Cancer Care information about today's program, and in that information, there was information about our speakers, about all of our collaborating organizations as a resource for you to use going forward. And also, there is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. You know, when you think about it, you're the best people to tell us the programs that we should be offering going forth. And we're entering soon a new year, 2013, and planning a lot of new programs. And so this particular program today on multiple myeloma is one that many of you have requested that we offer a few times a year. And if there are other aspects of multiple myeloma that you'd like us to be sure to cover, please put that in your evaluation. Or if there's other topics affecting your life and living with cancer, include those as well. We very much look to you to tell us what we should be doing to keep the programs most relevant to meet your particular needs. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today. And I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Wolf. And Dr. Wolf is Professor of Medicine, Director of Myeloma Program, Division of Hematology Oncology, Blood and Marrow Transplantation, University of California in San Francisco. And Dr. Wolf is going to address an overview of multiple myeloma, the current standard of care, and he's going to also address communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Wolf.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner, and welcome everybody. Myeloma is a cancer, and like all cancers, it's derived from a single cell. So a lung cancer would be derived from a lung cell and a breast cancer from a breast cell. In this case, myeloma is an overproduction of plasma cells. These are white cells that in normal circumstances make antibodies to protect us from infection. So for example, if you get a polio vaccine, you'll make antibodies to protect you from the polio virus. In the case of myeloma, one of these plasma cells becomes malignant and produces trillions of cells just like itself. And these cells make a single protein, and that protein is usually dysfunctional. It doesn't do anybody any good. It is called monoclonal because it is a single protein, and you can measure this in the blood, which is quite helpful in measuring the disease. However, these cells produce other substances as well that get patients into trouble. So the plasma cell produces these antibodies. The antibodies are made up of heavy chains and light chains. Sometimes the light chains are overproduced in a way that they cause kidney problems. Other substances are produced that attack the bones and cause loss of calcium and holes in the bone, which we call lytic lesions. These holes in the bone can lead to painful fractures, especially in the spine, where you can get compression of the vertebrae, and patients have tremendous pain. They become shorter, and it's often the way in which this disease presents. The fact that these cells only produce a large dysfunctional single protein means that they may not be producing all the other antibodies that the patient needs, and therefore the patient is immunocompromised or susceptible to many infections, and that's another serious problem for patients with myeloma. They either present with these infections or they're subject to these infections during their therapy. The plasma cells can also overgrow in the bone marrow. This is the nursery for blood cells, and they overgrow in a way that other cells aren't produced normally, and these patients may become anemic or their red blood cell count goes down. the substances that leach the calcium from the bone not only cause these bone lesions, but can cause the calcium in the blood to go up. So high calcium is another problem. Some of the substances that are produced can also attack the nerves of these patients. And even if they don't present with numbness and tingling, which some of them do present with, the treatment that we give them is particularly susceptible to causing them to have the numbness and tingling, the neuropathies that so affect our patients. Therapy for this disease, fortunately, has improved substantially over the last decade or two with the advent of a number of new drugs. One of the questions that we're asked to address is whether this disease is curable. The standard answer is that it's not curable. If any of the doctors here were taking a test tonight, they'd have to answer the question, no, it's not curable. But those of us on the call today do believe that we've made such substantial progress in the treatment of this disease that we may, in fact, be curing some people now, not everybody, but some people who go into a complete remission and may stay there for decades. We all have patients we treated even 20 years ago who remain in such a remission. So we may, in fact, be treating patients in a way today that is curing some of them, but we won't know for 10 or 20 years. And that's why we continue to push the envelope on how we treat patients. Standard therapy for patients today consists of three phases. Initial therapy, which we call induction therapy, where we try to get the disease under control, followed by, in many cases, an autologous stem cell transplantation. I'll talk about that for a few minutes. And then continuation therapy or maintenance therapy. Induction therapy is evolving quickly. With the advent of new drugs, we put new combinations together. And literally in the last 9 or 10 years, with the new drugs we have formed combinations of therapies, either two or three drug therapies that we use for induction. And with the three drug therapies, we actually are able to get almost 100% of patients to respond. That is, their protein levels drop for at least 50%. And perhaps a third to a half of them achieve a complete remission with just this initial therapy. Many centers, such as our own and the doctors in Boston believe in this as well, perform autologous stem cell transplantation following this because we believe that this is a form of consolidating the induction therapy, that is the initial three-drug therapy, often with lenalidomide and bortezomib. These are drugs that are otherwise known as Revlimid and Velcade, and then a steroid dexamethasone, can lead to a tremendous reduction in the amount of cancer, but it doesn't wipe it out entirely. So we believe in a consolidation phase in which we give the patient very high-dose chemotherapy, and then we rescue them with their own cells. This is called autologous transplantation. This is often followed by maintenance therapy or continued therapy, and there are a number of studies that show that there is benefit to this continuation therapy in that the disease does not come back as soon when the patient is on this continuation therapy. And there may be, there are some indications that this therapy actually does increase the number of people who are surviving at 3 or 5 years. So that this combination of therapy, which granted goes out many, many months and years, is what has led us to improve the overall survival and well-being of our patients over the last 10 years. Thank you.
Well, I'd love to thank you very much, Dr. Wolf, for just a wonderful really overview of multiple myeloma and really for really setting the context and also for identifying just the progress that's been made in treating multiple myeloma. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Kenneth Anderson. Dr. Anderson is Kraft Family Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's also Director of LeBeau Institute for Myeloma Therapeutics, and also Director Jerome Lipper Multiple Myeloma Center at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He's also American Cancer Society Clinical Research Professor. And Dr. Anderson is going to address new treatment approaches, clinical trial updates, and how clinical trials contribute to treatment options. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Anderson.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and it's a real privilege to be here. As Dr. Wolf so nicely summarized for us, there's been amazing progress over the last decade. We've literally seen a transformation in the treatment paradigm for this disease, and as a consequence, the outcome of patients is much, much better than ever before, and the best is yet to come. I would just mention that over the last decade, the appreciation that drugs that could target not only the tumor cell, but also the bone marrow where these malignant plasma cells reside in patients, and overcome the advantage that the bone marrow confers to the tumor cells, in other words, kill the tumor in the area where it grows in patients, has made a major difference in this disease. Bortezomib, the proteasome inhibitor, the immunomodulatory drugs lenalidomide and thalidomide are the first generation of a whole new series now of new agents. Each of them was used in advanced disease and then in relapse disease. Nowadays, they're all used up front as the initial treatment to consolidate or increase the depth of response and very excitingly as maintenance. And it's literally now we're able now to say to patients that pretty much everyone can respond to initial combinations of these new targeted agents, and the extent of response is better than ever before. So I think it's fair to say people are living 2 to 3 times as long. Many patients are living decades now with maintenance therapy. In large studies, we have people living longer and living longer without myeloma than ever before. Now, my topic is just to say what's new, and I think there are 4 different areas I'd like to briefly mention. Firstly, we have for a long time been searching for immune-based treatments for myeloma, and I'm happy to say that we have some antibodies that are able to recognize myeloma among normal cells when they're given and infused into patients and selectively target them for killing by the patient's own immune system. And a couple of those antibodies to mention, one is called elotuzumab, which together with lenalidomide to increase its activity is showing great promise at selectively killing tumor cells in patients with relapsed myeloma. And another one called daratumumab is also, just by itself at this point, just the antibody alone, able to achieve responses in far advanced myeloma. And the excitement here is that the immune system that all of us have, our God-given immune system, as I like to say, is more powerful than any other drugs. So if we could harness patients' own immune system to selectively reject the tumor, just as it rejects infections commonly, this would be a very powerful advance. So 2 antibodies, elotuzumab, in this case with lenalidomide, and secondly, daratumumab. I'm also secondly want to mention that we have the new generation of the proteasome inhibitors and the immunomodulatory drugs. So bortezomib was first, but many of you will know already, we have, as of this summer, carfilzomib, another proteasome inhibitor approved, which is more potent and its effects are longer, and fortunately it does not cause neuropathy. So it was granted accelerated approval this summer. We have an oral proteasome inhibitor called MLN9708, which is looking very promising and is oral without a lot of side effects, and a third one called merizumab. But suffice it to say, we have a whole new class of drugs, the proteasome inhibitor, which was introduced by bortezomib, but the new generation now, carfilzomib, MLN9708, and merizumab, offer even greater promise and are working even in the context where bortezomib is no longer effective. We also have second-generation immunomodulatory drugs, and the one I mentioned there I think is familiar to many of you, pomalidomide, given together with dexamethasone, when studied in multi-centers at the United States and also at the Mayo Clinic and also in France, is really remarkably achieving responses that are durable in roughly a third of patients whose myeloma really doesn't respond to anything else. And so that's, in my view, likely to be approved any day now for multiple myeloma as another example of how the second generation of these new classes of drugs are even better than the first class. So immune treatments, the antibodies, and then second generation of the proteasome inhibitors and the immunomodulatory drugs. In terms of combinations, I just want to mention that cancer is cured, really, when it is with combinations of treatments. We learned that in leukemia and Hodgkin's disease and testicular cancer many years ago, and so it will be in multiple myeloma. And so we're now combining with the proteasome inhibitors other classes of drugs, for example, the histone deacetylase inhibitors, to markedly increase their activity. I've already mentioned that the immunomodulatory drugs such as lenalidomide can markedly increase the activity of antibodies, but combinations of therapies are coming and really offer the most promise. To date, three drug combinations, lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone is one example, bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone as a second example, are now honestly achieving universal responses and significant extent of responses to a level we've never seen heretofore when used initially. So combinations are going to be very exciting. And then finally, in addition to the antibodies, the second generation of the agents, the combinations, the last thing I would mention is we're learning much, much more about the genetics of myeloma, so-called the genomics. Those mutations or those abnormalities that are fundamental to causing myeloma or allowing it to progress and resist drugs. And as we, together with all of our patients, learn these abnormalities, we will be much better able to categorize patients, target the abnormalities that are present in individual patients in a selective way, and deliver on the promise of personalized medicine. Now, we're all on the phone here about to go to the American Society of Hematology in Atlanta, which is a major meeting of about 20,000 hematologists, oncologists for all over the world. But I mention it because at this meeting, there will be remarkable progress in how to use the targeted agents that we already have, combinations, for example, of lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone, with a fourth drug called vorinostat, or an HDAC inhibitor. Not only three drugs, in other words, but four drug combinations. The new drugs I mentioned to you, the carfilzomib proteasome inhibitor and the pomalidomide immunomodulatory drug, each is very exciting in and of itself, but at this American Society of Hematology, we will hear what happens when you combine these two next-generation targeted therapies. So I think for those of you who are patients on the phone, there is every reason for optimism. I think the last thing I wanted to mention very quickly is the only reason that this progress has occurred is because of the willingness of patients to sign informed consent and be our heroes and inspiration by participating in clinical trials. You've just heard a remarkable story from Dr. Wolf and from myself. The point is, if you go and are treated on clinical trials, you are highly likely to benefit at this time, even though they're new medicines. What you're hearing is the promise and the science behind them is very high, and people really do respond to new drugs, and the level of care is clearly state of the art. So please consider very strongly participating in clinical trials. That's how we together will deliver on the promise and the hope that I hope you've heard from both Dr. Wolf and myself.
Thank you very much, Dr. Anderson. That was really just a wonderful presentation and a lot of hope and promise. And I know that you can feel the audience. We can't see everybody, but we can hear. We can feel that that's such a good thing for everyone to hear. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Dr. Nupur Rajay. And Dr. Rajay is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. She's also Director of Center for Multiple Myeloma and Division of Hematology and Oncology at Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Rajay is going to address the reducing complications of bone disease, practical tips for symptom and pain management, and physical activity concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Rajay.
Thank you, Carolyn. It is a privilege to be here on this call. We have just heard so nicely from both Dr. Wolf and Dr. Anderson on an excellent overview of myeloma and its therapy. And as you all have just heard, the use of all of these novel agents has really helped transform myeloma into a fairly chronic disease. And is not only an exciting time for all of us in research, but I do believe is exciting for the opportunities that patients have to be able to avail of these drugs. Because of all of this rapid evolution, because of all of the wonderful things you've heard in the past 20 minutes or so. I would really encourage all of you to seek out your clinical trials which are available at your sites and see if any of these would be appropriate for you to participate in. My job right now is to focus on discussing strategies at reducing complications, mainly from bone disease, and then talk a little bit about symptoms and pain management, which sometimes is associated with myeloma. And honestly, discussing these aspects are largely a reflection of, again, the chronicity of this disease. As a consequence, people are living longer, and symptom control is becoming center stage when it comes to taking care of myeloma. It is critically important that you engage with your care team, you communicate your symptoms so that your team is going to be able to help deal with these symptoms effectively. And your care team, your care should be a team effort, and honestly, you should be at the center of that team. When thinking about symptoms, we will talk first about symptoms related to myeloma itself. Dr. Wolf has discussed a lot of the symptoms related to the disease, and some of these result from the protein which is secreted by these tumor cells either in the blood or the urine as well as the bone marrow. Symptoms of bone pain and anemia remain some of the most common features which affect more than 80% of people. Other features can include problems because of high calcium levels in the blood, kidney dysfunction, and infection. All of these symptoms can obviously be treated by treating the underlying myeloma itself. There are, however, certain things which we generally recommend in terms of supportive care strategies, and they help take care of your multiple myeloma better. Some of these are directed towards bone, and bone-directed strategies at the current time include the use of drugs which come under the category of what is referred to as bisphosphonates, and these include drugs like pirfenidone or zoledronic acid, and these are recommended for everybody with myeloma and specifically everybody who has myeloma-related bone disease. These bone-strengthening agents have proven in randomized trials to decrease the incidence of complications such as pain, fractures, need for radiation. There's been a large randomized trial which was done in England, and what this trial has ended up showing is patients who were treated with the intravenous zoledronic acid actually lived longer from their myeloma as well. There are other things which can be done for myeloma-related bone disease, specifically if things like fractures are causing low back pain. These include procedures such as vertebral augmentation. They include vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty. These are fairly easy procedures. They're outpatient procedures. You go in, get the procedure done, and you're back home the same day. And what it essentially involves is injecting a little bit of cement into your vertebral body or your spine bone, which is the cause of the pain. In certain situations, we do tend to use radiation, but we like to use it sparingly. And sometimes patients with myeloma do need to get a surgical procedure for their bones so that they would not be at a risk for fracture. Excitingly, we have several novel agents currently undergoing testing, both in the laboratories as well as in the clinical setting. These are bone anabolic agents, and what these agents really do is cause bone formation. In the old days, we used to talk about myeloma bones having the bone disease and this bone disease not healing, but the good news now is that we have drugs which can actually address this, and these are in clinical trials, a couple of them which we testing as we speak include antibodies against the protein called DKK1. There's another antibody which we're using in the clinic already, which is an antibody against a cytokine called Activin A. The future, therefore, for the treatment of myeloma bone disease is likely going to incorporate not just the bisphosphonates, but with the bisphosphonates, we're going to also add on some of these new bone healing drugs, so to speak. We also have another new antibody, not quite new. It's called denosumab. It has been approved in certain other cancer types. In myeloma, it's currently being studied for the treatment of bone disease, and we will soon know whether whether in addition to the zoledronic acid and pomidronate, we can also consider using denosumab in this setting. Fatigue due to anemia is another common symptom. We have growth factors such as erythropoietin, which can be administered to help with this anemia. Many physicians begin to use EPO in patients where the hemoglobin levels falls below 10 grams. The use of drugs like EPO, though, should be considered carefully, and you have to be discussing this with your physician, treating physician, because they do have certain risks, such as risk of blood clots, etc. Kidney dysfunction is not uncommon in patients, and keeping up with lots of hydration, so drinking plenty and plenty of fluids, anywhere between 2 and 3 liters of fluid a day, is always a good thing for your kidneys. Finally, myeloma patients do tend to be at a risk for developing infections, and patients should take the onset of fevers seriously. We do tend to treat you with antibiotics should you have a cough or cold, so please call your healthcare provider and make sure it's taken care of. Although all the novel agents that you've heard from, both from Dr. Wolf as well as Dr. Anderson, are very effective and generally very well tolerated, they do cause some side effects. And again, communicating those symptoms to your healthcare team is critical, because it's going to allow your team to either change the dosage or change the way the drug is being given so that you're able to better tolerate this. This is becoming incredibly important now, because Dr. Anderson mentioned the role of using maintenance treatments so that we use some of these drugs for protracted periods of time. And the critical piece there is for us to be able to understand whether or not you can tolerate these drugs and how best to modify their use. For example, drugs like thalidomide and lenalidomide can certainly predispose patients to blood clots. Depending on whether or not you're combining them with chemotherapy or with steroids, we sometimes will use blood thinners like Coumadin or low molecular weight heparin, but most times we get away by just using aspirin. Decrease in blood counts is also common with certain drugs like lenalidomide, and therefore checking blood counts at certain intervals is important. Adjusting the dose of lenalidomide if your blood counts go down should be done so that you're not more predisposed to infections as well. Bortezomib or Velcade is a very useful proteasome inhibitor in the treatment of myeloma, but if used for protracted periods of time, can cause neuropathy, which results in pain and loss of sensation. Once this sets in, we do have very specific guidelines as to how one modifies the dose of bortezomib. What we've learned over the last couple of years now is that we can actually use this bortezomib under the skin or give it subcutaneously. And if we do it or treat patients with bortezomib by the subcutaneous route, you really do reduce the risk of neuropathy by about twofold. Symptomatic treatment of neuropathy includes drugs like gabapentin. We have newer agents such as Cymbalta and Lyrica as well, which do help with the control of neuropathy. Again, modifying how you receive drugs like bortezomib so that giving bortezomib once a week as opposed to doing it twice a week also does help mitigate some of these side effects. Vitamin supplements, specifically vitamin B, may be useful as an adjunct for the treatment of neuropathy. Neuropathy is also sometimes seen with thalidomide, and again, dose adjusting the thalidomide at that time is generally helpful. Finally, keeping up with physical therapy and exercise helps decrease problems not only associated with neuropathy, but also is of great benefit to bone disease and keeping your bones strong. Given the complexity of both the symptoms and the available therapies for myeloma, I think partnering with your healthcare team and communicating with your team regarding symptoms and concerns, all the concerns that you have regarding your myeloma, will help you manage your myeloma so much better. Again, I cannot underscore the importance of participating in some of the clinical trials you have, because as Dr. Anderson pointed out earlier on, a lot of the work which goes into clinical trials is informed by a lot of preclinical work before we get to that clinical trial, so the chances of those drugs working in clinical trials tends to be fairly high. I'm going to stop here, Carolyn. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Rajay. Excellent presentation as always, and just also for just highlighting, you know, the management of side effects and also the importance, again, of clinical trial participation. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Effie Roman. And Effie is a colleague of mine. She's an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. She is a coordinator of our programs and Cancer Care. And Ms. Roman is going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care, the role of support groups, and also she's going to tell you about a novel program that we have called Door to Door, which helps people with multiple myeloma with their transportation assistance program. So I'm going to turn this program now over to Ms. Roman.
Thank you, Carolyn, and it is a pleasure to be part of this telephone education workshop. I'm going to talk about the importance of building and strengthening your support network and the services of Cancer Care. Multiple myeloma patients and their families have numerous issues that can impact your life, such as concerns about treatment, insurance, jobs, or who will help their loved ones. When in treatment, additional issues of self-esteem due to side effects as well as treatment-related fatigue can impact normal activities of daily living. These issues and others can create anxiety and uncertainty. And with chronic cancers over time, these stresses can impact the family's health as well as the health of those providing the support. That's why building relationships with all members of your healthcare team, which usually includes a doctor, nurse, social worker, billing person, and other professionals, is so important. It is helpful to think of this as a partnership or cooperation. They are your primary treatment network and are the experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and life. For that reason, mutual respect can go a long way to foster the best treatment care. It is also important to build a personal support network, usually consisting of family and friends from your neighborhood, work, community center, or house of worship. For many patients, it is hard to say, I need help. But for people who care about you, helping is one way they can give. That is why, with a chronic illness, building a support network is so important. And by reaching out to as many as possible, will help the caregiver spread the help and thereby help themselves. Accepting changes are normal during treatment and can contribute toward nurturing your body and spirit. But stresses can also elicit feelings of sadness, anger, and frustration. What is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless, scared, and sad as well. This is when it is helpful to seek the help of a social worker and other professionals from organizations such as Cancer Care. Cancer Care has oncology social workers who inform people of resources and strategies for finding help, which can include building a phone tree, to update your social network, creating a blog for those who are computer savvy, or mind-body-spirit techniques to calm the mind and relax the body during times of stress. At Cancer Care, along with education and resources, we provide some financial assistance, such as an enhanced transportation grant for patients with multiple myeloma to help get them to the care they need. These covered costs include gas, tolls, parking, car service, ambulette, and paratransit, as well as counseling, regional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online support groups for patients and loved ones. Groups provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation that you are not alone. To many support groups, social supports, and getting to know your healthcare team can go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenges of cancer. As daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. If you would like to speak with an oncology social worker, please contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org for more information.
Well, thank you very much, Effie, for just a wonderful presentation about all the different services that people can access from Cancer Care, and we hope you'll take advantage of those services as well. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, then you'll just call our 800 number, 1-800-813-HOPE, and speak with our call center staff, and they'll be happy to address your questions. But for now, let's see how many we can take. And so, Stephanie, would you tell everybody how to queue up and ask questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Our first question comes from Michelle G. Your line is open.
Hi. I'm a 9-year multiple myeloma survivor, and I want to thank Dr. Anderson and all of the other wonderful researchers who've helped me to live a very active and full life. I am, however, recently stopped responding to treatments and am going to transplant, and I wanted to ask Dr. Anderson if the number of cells that are actually transplanted has any relationship to outcomes.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for being on this call, and we appreciate your telling everyone that you've been living with multiple myeloma for 9 years, and your question is an excellent one, and I'm going to ask Dr. Anderson if he can address it in a general way, and then we'll hope you'll take the information that Dr. Anderson provides and bring it back to your healthcare team. Dr. Anderson?
Sure thing. Now, firstly, we should celebrate. We are, all of us on the phone are incredibly happy and gratified and could not be happier to appreciate your 9-year survivorship. But as we have all said, that is a good start, but we need to improve on that. I think a high-dose therapy and stem cell transplant it can be very effective. What I can tell you specifically is we know the minimum number of cells that we need in order to get reconstitution or, if you will, reformation of your blood and immune system, and it's about 2 million so-called stem cells that we can identify and call CD34 positive per kilogram of body weight. When we use higher numbers than that, as your question implies, the engraftment, the reforming of the blood and immune system can be much more rapid. I do think the outcome, though, if we have a minimum number of cells, which we always do to go forward safely, is very, very positive. And I don't think we can say that because there's more cells, you'll do better. I think you will engraft more quickly, however. And I think the use of agents such as lenalidomide, for example, after the transplant really have improved the outcome of the transplant markedly. So, you know, we do try to capitalize and use the right numbers of cells, but I think what's really changed the transplant outcome is the use of new drugs in combination before the transplant, new drugs now right after the transplant to consolidate or make the depth of response greater, and then thirdly, the use of maintenance drugs, novel agents as maintenance to prolong that response for many, many years.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Brenda S. Your line is open.
Yes, I didn't hear any mention of GammaGuard to take care of your immune system.
Okay, thank you for that question. Dr. Wolf, could you address that question?
Sure. As I mentioned early on, when patients have myeloma, it is not unusual for their normal immune system to be suppressed, and they may not make enough normal gamma globulin, and in cases where we can either measure that their gamma globulins are low or where the patients have repeated infections, it's not unusual for us to treat them with either treatment-related or prophylactic preventive gamma globulin, and GammaGuard is one of those.
Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Marvin H. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Marvin's wife speaking. Marvin, about 2 years ago, was treated with Velcade, and in about the third cycle, he started getting severe neuropathy, which they don't know whether it was from the Velcade or the disease itself. So the question is, are the second-generation drugs, for example, the ones that's related to Velcade, do they have the same type of side effects? And what new therapies do you have that have the least amount of neuropathy as a side effect?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. Thank you. And I'm going to ask Dr. Rajay if she would address that.
Sure. So that's an excellent question. And, you know, for people like Marvin, I certainly think we have new options now. Velcade in itself can cause neuropathy, but more importantly, as Dr. Wolf had mentioned earlier as well, myeloma, the myeloma protein can also cause neuropathy in certain patients. What can one do about this? Well, we do have newer drugs. Dr. Anderson mentioned carfilzomib, which is the newest generation proteasome inhibitor, which has been approved for the treatment of myeloma now. And the neat thing about carfilzomib is it is not neurotoxic, does not cause neuropathy. I will also mention some of the newer oral proteasome inhibitors that we have, specifically the MLN9708, which is the oral counterpart of Velcade now. That also has very little in terms of neuropathy. The whole range of IMIDs, such as lenalidomide and the newest one, which hopefully will get approved very soon, pomalidomide, also does not have a whole lot of neuropathy. So lots of different options in terms of non-neurotoxic drugs for Marvin and others.
A question from one of our online participants, Marilyn. What about treating older patients who cannot withstand autologous stem cell transplant? Dr. Anderson, do you want to address that?
Surely. The use of novel drugs that I mentioned earlier, often in combination, can be extended to the non-transplant or older patients as well. For example, the combination of the first-generation lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone, albeit at slightly attenuated doses, can achieve remarkable responses even in the elderly patients with myeloma. In Europe, more commonly than in the United States, melphalan and prednisone oral treatment, which has been known for 50 years, is now being given commonly, but it's being given together with one of these novel agents, either thalidomide, lenalidomide, or bortezomib. And in fact, at the American Society of Hematology that I mentioned earlier, to happen next week, we will hear now exciting data that when you put melphalan, prednisone, together with bortezomib and thalidomide, an Italian study shows that there's marked prolongation in overall survival, really quite incredible, by using new drugs. So I do think no matter whether you're younger and a transplant candidate or older and are not, that everyone should be receiving novel drugs now as part of their initial treatment and likely as part of their maintenance as well. So the answer to your question is the benefit really does extend to all patients of myeloma. That is the benefit of the new drugs.
Well, thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from John N. Your line is open.
Yes, my question has to do with insurance coverage, both Medicare and private, and the whether it's effective or not if you participate in a trial.
Now, that's an excellent question, and I think that, you know, there is variability per trial, and I wonder if, Dr. Anderson, if you could address that. Not all trials are covered. And
no, I think it's a super question, and, you know, it is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most important questions you could ever ask, because what you've heard here today is that we're together making remarkable progress, but it really only matters if patients who really need these new drugs have access and have the ability to be treated. And so there have been many efforts. I'll just mention quickly a couple. The National Comprehensive Cancer Center Network, which is a group of cancer centers in the United States, has guidelines. And the reason that we do is to sort of guide treatment, but more importantly, to include wherever we can in the treatment for us today of multiple myeloma, whether it be newly diagnosed, relapsed, or relapsed refractory, or maintenance, always includes the option of a clinical trial. And CMS, which in other words is the Medicare and Medicaid, and many of the large insurance companies now in the United States and around the world have adopted those guidelines for reimbursement purposes. My sincerest hope is this was part of the healthcare bill that was passed earlier, so-called Obamacare, which has been quite changed since its passage. But one of the common things that one would hope that everyone could agree on is right, the answer to your question, There is no reason why we can't have coverage for care on clinical trials that everyone could agree with. And I hope as we start to hear more discussions by our political leaders and hopefully some compromises, that we can all be vocal about this and assure that the answer to your question is an overwhelming yes, that patients with cancer do not need to worry about the additional stress of paying for a clinical trial if they're unable to do so. So the answer is, I think, please don't let it be a discouragement to enrolling on clinical trials. Those of us on the phone will be your tremendous advocates in making it happen one way or another, including the reimbursement.
Thank you, and thank you, John, for asking that question, and thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Donna R. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hi, Donna.
Hello.
Question. Hi, Donna. Request your question.
My name is Donna. What I am asking, I am taking a combination of Revlimid, dexamethasone, and Valfe. I'm taking it in a period of time, but now it's like it's giving me, like a bug. I just having a diarrhea, and for about 3 weeks now, going on to a month.
And your question, Donna?
What really caused it, because, I'm just keep going and can't stop. So.
Okay. Well, Donna, that was an excellent question. Dr. Rajay, can you answer that question in a general way in terms of the issue of dealing with diarrhea, if you could address
that? Sure. So, diarrhea tends to be common in people who stay on drugs like Revlimid for long periods of time. So when you stay on Revlimid for beyond 1 and 2 years, some folks can end up getting diarrhea. Most of the times this is kind of a benign diarrhea, and we would treat it symptomatically. So symptomatic treatment would be using drugs like stool binders to help prevent the diarrhea. Certain dietary changes are also recommended, more fiber in your diet and so on and so forth. But outside of that, it's generally not of concern if this is not an infectious diarrhea. But this is something which is commonly seen in people beyond 2 and 3 years on lenalidomide. Imodium would be the drug of choice, which would be to help prevent this diarrhea, but a lot of kind of symptomatic treatment alone.
Excellent. So, Donna, we recommend that you really take this information back to your treating healthcare team. This is a very difficult symptom. And also, do you want to comment, Dr. Rajay, about hydration issues when there's a lot of diarrhea?
Absolutely. We talked about hydration to try and keep your kidneys happy with myeloma. And specifically, if you are losing a lot of water through diarrhea, that's going to be a problem. So keeping yourself well hydrated, very critical, specifically if you're having this diarrhea, so 2 to 3 liters of fluid, and then really treating the diarrhea with drugs which can stop it. And just symptomatic over-the-counter drugs are all that's really required.
Thank you. We have another question from one of our online participants, Kathy. What is the current recommended treatment schedule for Zometa for patient with ongoing myeloma? Dr. Rajay, would you address that?
So again, a very important question on how frequently one should be given Zometa, and we're going to be presenting some of this data at the American Society of Hematology meeting next week, where we have treated myeloma patients who are in a good remission with zoledronic acid given every 3 months, and at least based on our initial experience in about 120-odd patients, our feeling is that it would be safe to do it that way. Obviously, discussions on less frequent dosing have to be in concert with your treating physician. So discuss this, but there is a move to using these drugs less frequently if your disease is stable and in a good remission.
And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Sharon P. Your line is open.
Yes, hi, and thank you for a really good presentation. I'm 69 currently, and after 6 rounds of Revlimid and 4 rounds of Velcade, got to complete molecular remission, and I had a stem cell harvest, but my doctor has recommended not being on maintenance and just doing, every 3-month checkups. I wondered if I wonder if either one of the doctors could comment on the risk of secondary cancers with maintenance follow-up.
Thank you for that excellent question. And Dr. Wolf, would you be able to address that question, please?
Sure. It's always difficult to make a specific recommendation for a specific patient without seeing the whole picture. But in general, I think that certainly the three of us on the line would recommend maintenance of some form in this setting, not unlike what we do for patients after transplantation with lenalidomide or bortezomib, perhaps. But interestingly, it sounds like you were treated with not the two drugs at the same time, but you had Revlimid followed by Velcade. I think it's a difficult question. You've already been harvested. I would tend to recommend maintenance, but I think that's between you and your doctor.
And I'm going to just.
I'd like to know what the other doctors think as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Maybe I could. Yeah. Carolyn just mentioned this
please,
is Ken Anderson, and I agree totally with Jeff. I think that when you hear about the secondary cancers, I think that there probably is a real, very small but real risk of secondary cancers when lenalidomide is used after transplant or after even in the non-transplant patients if, in fact, alkylating agents or DNA-damaging agent drugs are been used. The reason I mention that is if you haven't had such drugs, the patient that's been asking the question here, and so in that context, at least so far, there is no risk of a secondary cancer. And just to echo what Jeff said, those of us who have been doing myeloma for a while will appreciate that if one doesn't use maintenance, myeloma will return. It's just a matter of when. Lenalidomide at low doses is really the first time we've been able to double progression-free survival and extend survival. Not only in the United States, but that's now coming true in the European studies as well. So the benefit is overwhelming. It's well tolerated. And secondly, the risk of the cancers tends to be in the setting where there's been prior DNA damaging agents. That isn't the case for the patient that just asked this question. So I think I would go along with Jeff's recommendation at some kind of maintenance, but also defer to your provider as well.
I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of your question, but I agree with Dr. Anderson that the incidence of second malignancies is seen in other settings and has not really been shown to be the case with using Revlimid in this setting.
And we really appreciate this forum for people to ask questions. You understand, of course, that we all don't have access to your records, but we do make general statements here, and sometimes people have listened to our programs here and thought, maybe I should consider getting a second opinion. We're not saying that that's always the case. We certainly do want you to work closely with your treating healthcare team. But we also certainly recommend that you feel confident about what you're doing. I wonder if, Dr. Ajay, would you want to comment just on the concept of second opinion and that I don't know if it's quite considered the standard of care, but many people do often consider getting a second opinion or...
Yeah, no, absolutely. Getting a second opinion is always a good idea if you have any concerns or even a question about your care. The other thing which I will mention is, myeloma is changing very rapidly. With I think every time we all get together and talk about myeloma, the good news is we have a lot of new stuff to talk about. And it does not necessarily always percolate to the community right away. So checking in with the center, which sees a lot more myeloma, is definitely a good idea if you're able to do that. I do think even the healthcare providers actually appreciate the fact that a second opinion is asked for by a patient, because we then tend to work a lot. For example, in my practice at least, we will have physicians from outside send patients over, and we will send them back to the community to get taken care of there. So getting an opinion, getting a second set of eyes to look at all your numbers is not a bad idea. If you're comfortable with your care, continue doing what you're doing. But I think most of us in the healthcare world have nothing against a second opinion. It's always a good idea.
Thank you. Now, we have a question from one of our online participants, Alicia, and the question is, wondering about the status of a vaccine trial for SMM. Will it start soon? Dr. Anderson, do you want to address that?
Sure. There are a couple of different kinds of vaccines in myeloma that are showing great promise. One of them, for example, actually vaccinates patients against their own myeloma cell, the entire multiple myeloma cell, and in preclinical experiments in animal models, and now in clinical trials in patients, such vaccinations have actually achieved at least stable disease, even in patients with active multiple myeloma. That was reported about a year ago. What I think the question is really getting to is that there are now vaccine strategies that are going to be starting, which are dedicated to, in early stages, so-called smoldering multiple myeloma, which would not otherwise be treated, try to induce in patients an immune response against their own multiple myeloma. And that's very exciting because patients who aren't receiving other treatment have as normal an immune system as they'll ever have, so they're more likely to respond. And these vaccines now are specialized, if you will, to make it much more likely that patients who are vaccinated will respond. So Dr. Raji is going to be the principal investigator of this trial, but it's imminent to open within weeks, probably by the end of this year. And its goal is to try to induce an immune reaction, which I mentioned earlier is very powerful, and see if by so doing one can actually delay, or wouldn't it be nice if someday we could prevent the development of active myeloma and just keep it in a smoldering condition by having an immune response from this vaccine. So the answer is it's starting imminently, certainly within weeks and by the end of the year.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been extraordinary. This has been an amazing call, and we're going to definitely have you all back by popular demand. And I want to thank all of you on the call who asked really such really thoughtful and important questions and really cutting-edge questions. So we definitely had a great audience on the call today as well. Now, this is a one-hour workshop, and that in doing a program like this, we know that you have so many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to bring you back to the fact that although the call may be ending soon, the services that you can access, the help that you can access, that continues endlessly. You have a phone number for cancer care, 1-800-813-HOPE. We're staffed with about 40 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to answer your questions, provide practical and financial assistance. Also, we offer counseling services and also support groups, both on the telephone and online. We have lots of materials and booklets, and we also can help to connect you with many other resources for help and assistance. So we don't want anyone to leave this call feeling like you're alone. We're also we are in the midst of a holiday season, and most importantly, that you all get the support you need, both those of you living with multiple myeloma and your caregivers as well. So please do stay tuned, participate in our upcoming programs, and know that we're simply a telephone call away or a mouse click away. You're not alone. You're part of this community of support now. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.